It may be useful to start by saying something about the whole notion of prehistory itself, because it's a very recent idea. When Marx was a young man, first half of the 19th century, the general officially accepted view of the world, taught in the various institutions of learning, was that actually it hadn't existed for very long. The usual calculation made Church of England was that actually it had been created in 4004 BC, although there were some disputes as to whether it had happened in the February or the October of that year. But in any case, this was the official viewpoint, right? So that, you know, then you look at Adam, you know, Genesis, we start through Adam, then we have Abram, Isaac, all the rest of it, and in no time at all, we are down to historical times, so to say. Now, of course it is the case that in the previous century, many of the thinkers of the Enlightenment had realized that this simply would not do, had speculated about evolution in terms, not of human society primarily, but in terms of the natural world. But these ideas, although they had been floating around in what they call advanced circles in the previous century, had become, as a result of the intellectual reaction following the aftermath of the French Revolution, not respectable, not the sort of thing that you wanted to talk about, especially if you wanted to get on the academic world and the church and so on and so forth. Now, in the course, the middle of the century, there's a really fundamental shift. It had been, we can see, looking back, accumulating for a long, long time. But the time was ripe, so to say, for the new ideas to break out. In 1859, three very important books were published. As a matter of fact, nowadays, the sort of books you would think hardly anyone would be interested in reading. But what people are interested in reading depends on the circumstances. The first one was, of course, The Origin of Species Through Natural Selection, Darwin. 5,000 printed, and they thought, optimistically they thought, you know, with a bit of luck, we'll get shut of these in 2 or 3 years, a fair rate of turnover, actually sold out in 24 hours. And it is a thick and not exactly easily read book. In the same year, Marx's contribution to the Critique of Political Economy, the preface of which contains the famous formal statement of historical materialism, and in the same year, a book by a man called Lubbock, who I imagine people have not heard of, but was had a comparable effect at the time, demonstrating for the benefit of anyone who is really capable of understanding the meaning of evidence, that actually in Europe, there had been men around for a long, long time. How long, of course, is a matter of speculation, but for a long, long time. Now, all these things coming at the same time made the idea of evolution in the general sense, after a furious argument against the old ideas, accepted. Accepted, not of course by the intellectual equivalents of those professors who support Margaret Thatcher today, but accepted, not just on the left, but if you like, in a certain sense, in the mainstream of thought. One important consequence of that, therefore, was the notion of the evolution of human societies. Now, it's an interesting fact that if you look at the history of ideas, there are periods when certain theories which at not only an earlier but a later time would be quite unacceptable in a particular kind of class society are acceptable. A very important fact we need to realise about this period, the 1860s, 1870s, was that the bourgeoisie was confident. They did not, they had, you know, overcome 1848, 1849, the system was expanding. They really believed that they represented the peak of human civilization. They believed in the idea of progress. They believed that the future could only be better than the past. And they believed, of course, that fundamentally the future was already here. The future was what existed in Britain under Queen Victoria, with, you know, minor variations. Now, that view, however absurd it may seem to you, nevertheless is a view that permitted them a more scientific view of the past than the bourgeoisie and its official institutions can afford to consider today. Consequently, the whole notion of the evolution of human society in the course of a couple of decades, great mass of work was produced. What did it amount to? Well, I don't want to spend very long on the matter, so I will take up two questions only. One, there was the assumption, an assumption which turned out to be wrong, but which paradoxically enough was a necessary error, the assumption that there is a uniform evolution of human societies. Each society goes through a series of stages. Uniform causes produce uniform results. That's a quotation from a man called Tyler, the first, most prominent British writer on the subject. And therefore they attempted to construct, on the basis of somewhat limited information, a picture of the past. Past evolution culminating in Victorian capitalism. What did it amount to? Well, they looked around the world. People had been doing that before, of course, but they looked at the evidence with fresh eyes, and they said, basically, there are three fundamental stages in the development of human society. One, there is a stage where people grub out a living by hunting, by gathering fruit, small game and so on, the hunter-gatherer stage. Okay? Using a not very happy terminology, which had been actually developed by the Scottish Enlightenment thinker, a man called Ferguson, in the previous century, they call that savagery. Then you look around and you see that there are other societies, quite primitive, but basically existing on agriculture, supplemented by hunting. But they are cultivators. They know how to cultivate the soil. Right? This, again following Ferguson's terminology, they call barbarism. Again, not a very happy choice of words perhaps, but this is the specific sense in which they were used. It's important to realise these words, this terminology is in no sense peculiarly Marxist, right? It was inherited by the Marxists. And then there are societies basically in which there is writing and therefore records and therefore history in the proper sense. Without records there can be no history in the formal sense. These we call civilization. Threefold definition. Now, it's not a bad one, actually. It was elaborated by various people. I will now briefly state how that was defined by Morgan. Morgan wrote a book, he wrote several books, but he published in 1871 a book called Ancient Society. This book, profoundly influenced both Marx and Engels, elaborated the criteria. It said, we define a savage society as one that is without agriculture. That is to say, where the population depends wholly on hunting and gathering. Morgan then proceeded to set up three theoretical stages of that, which I'm not going to bother with. They're not sustainable anyway. Then, barbarism, we define by agriculture and pottery. Now, and finally, civilization, we define in terms of writing. Now, it's important to notice that that definition, that set of definitions, is in a certain sense objective. That is to say, in principle, it doesn't depend whether you like the setup or not that you are observing. You've set up some criteria which are not dependent on your individual prejudices. Okay? Now, having got this far, you ask yourself, well, how the hell do we know all this anyway? Right? And their answer was as follows. Look around the world and you will see societies at each stage of development, except to the very earliest. Again, Morgan's statement. They are sort of living fossils. Here you have societies, some of them still surviving well on into the 19th century, which are pre-agricultural, rapidly disappearing. Nevertheless, they are there. Good, study them. They represent what everybody was like X thousand years ago. They had no means of putting dates on these things at that time. That represents that stage. Similarly, primitive cultivators, slash and burn agriculture, so on and so forth, that represents the thing. Now there's a difficulty, and obviously it's a very appealing idea, because it means that the past is still living, and you can actually use the evidence from these societies to construct a picture of what our own was like in the remote past. There's a difficulty with it, which I'm sure will have occurred to people. If it's the case that uniform courses produce uniform results, and there are universal stages, and everyone goes through the same stages, what the hell are these living fossils doing still living? Right? It is a serious intellectual difficulty. Nevertheless, they've managed to overlook it in their enthusiasm for the scheme. Now, final point in this connection, it is not possible for anyone to look seriously at the surviving primitive societies of the last century, and many of them survived until well on into this century, without realising one fundamental fact. Already, this was apparent to people in the 1860s, and Morgan in particular was responsible for elaborating it into a general notion. It is this. Whereas in most of the societies we are familiar with, people are individuals in some sense or other, and they have relationships which have something to do with actual descent, and they are organized in terms of political units on some kind of territorial basis, right? With primitive societies, this is not the case. All the primitive societies known at that time, and for that matter, the living fossils are dying off at a rate of knots, right? What we know now, all primitive societies that we know anything about were based on kinship. Now, kinship does not, however, mean what it means to us in the technical definition. It does not necessarily mean that they are genetically related to one another, although they believe that they are. It's something quite different. It is that the individual is not really very significant. I don't mean there are no differences between them, but that basically you are part of a unit, a collectivity. I will use the term clan. Morgan had a different terminology. The word the clan in system is a more familiar thing to us. It's a group thing. You are either born into it or adopted into it, and incidentally people at this stage in these sort of societies don't recognise the difference. Right? It is not the case. They know that you weren't born into it. There's no difference. It's a magical thing. You see, you go through the appropriate ritual, then you are of them. Secondly, they use, and this struck Morgan as enormously important, to describe their relations with one another. They describe not what we would call the real facts, but what he called a classificatory system. It works like this. Typical clan system, he studied the Iroquois in northern New York, but the details differ, the same principle applies to all societies of this type, clan of the kinship type. There is a group, and you have names for the people in the group. You're a particular generation, you were born, let's assume it's a matrilineal system, right? Your mother is a member of the clan, that's why you're a member of the clan. But you don't distinguish between her and all the women of her generation. They're all called mother, or rather, whatever the word in the language is. Yes? Similarly, you have sisters and brothers born into the thing. Again, you do not distinguish between those that are actually the children of either your mother or your father or what have you, and all the others. The system is classificatory. Now, is that clear to people? Because if that is not clear, what follows will, you know, get increasingly cloudy. Let me repeat it. Not the actual relationship as we would understand it, but the clan is the important thing. Yes? This is centrally important. Not the individual family, although individual families do exist in varying ways under this system, it is the clan. What is more, the immense pressure, socialization under this system, very, very much greater than in more advanced kinds of societies. And for a very obvious reason, incidentally, precarious mode of existence, low productivity of labour means social solidarity must be correspondingly great. Now, everything is done in terms then of planned relationships. There is no no state, no special bodies of armed men. Right? That's the first and obvious thing. Kinship societies are not class societies. Second thing, we now know something that Morgan did not know. We've got, as a result of the development of archaeology and some spin-offs from physics and so on, we now know that societies of this type occupied 99.9% of the time. Were the only kind of societies, were something like 99.9% of all the time. You know, the human species, our present species, even its closely related species, have existed for something over a million years, possibly considerably longer than that. Therefore, they are fantastically stable. Another way of saying the same thing. Now, we can observe them, and we need to observe certain things about them, but the most important thing I want to talk about in this connection, because it's the only thing that really interests people about it, as a matter of fact, most people anyway, is the question of the relationship between the sexes. And I will present, first of all, how Morgan saw it. He looked at the Iroquois, and he saw, right, what happens? There is a sexual division of labour. Women do certain kinds of things, men do certain other kinds of things. That's the first point. That, too, incidentally, is, so far as we know, universally true. That is to say, it's true of all the pre-class societies of which we actually know anything at all. Secondly, in the particular case of the Iroquois, these people are cultivators at a fairly low level. Fairly primitive, but nevertheless, they are cultivators. The raising of corn is the central economic fact. It is done by women. It is done on the clan lands which are owned, in inverted commas, the concept of ownership is a bit dodgy, of course, in this connection, by the clan. Membership of the clan is reckoned in the female line. The fields that they lived in, these so-called longhouses, must have been a terrible lack of privacy, you know, teen couples accommodated in the same place. Similar things existed in Europe, by the way, in prehistoric times, we know from the archaeological record. Now then, the membership of the clan went in the female line. The female, the matrilineal clan, is in the sense that you can talk about ownership, the owner of the fields, the women do the agricultural work, or predominantly do so. Consequently, the status of women in Iroquois society was, by our standards, high. This fact astonished people like Morgan, because they took it for granted that these benighted barbarians, you know, to use his technical description, must have necessarily been inferior in all respects, you see, to civilized people like me. Lawyer in Rochester, New York. And the fact is, they were not. The status of women in Iroquois society was quite high. That does not mean to say, by the way, that, as some people suppose, they actually ran everything. It does mean that property, essentially the important property, was in the hands of a female collective, or set of female collectives. The way the marriage system works is interesting. We'll deal with it very briefly, not in the complication that Morgan does. You see, within the clan, it is not possible to marry. More accurately, it is not possible to marry within certain subgroups in the clan, but we'll call it the clan. I'd simplify the thing. This, the famous incest taboo, again applies not to your actual genetic relations simply, but to your classificatory relations. Even if they have been adopted as captives and so on and have nothing whatever to do, you know, in a genetic sense, are quite remote. If they're a different colour or what have you, it doesn't matter. There is an incest taboo. Precisely why, this is one of the most controversial questions, and there are all sorts of theories about it. I'm going to say nothing about them, because the truth is, we do not know. This system is much older than we can see back. Right? So we state the fact. You must marry out of the clan, therefore. What happens is, in fact, your choice is somewhat limited. By arrangement, there are other groups that you can marry into and others that you can't. You then, in the case of the males, right, you leave the household of your mothers, which means, remember, not just her, but all the females of that age generation, and you go and live in another one. You don't, however, become a member of that other clan. You are, how shall we put it, a tolerated guest. And if you actually fall out with the female of your choice, I mean, she invites you in, and she throws you out, well, it's not the case that you've nowhere to go. It's not a class society, that sort of thing. No, no, you've got to go back to mother. Or rather, to the mother, which was regarded in error class society, by the way, as rather socially disgraceful. So, you make attempts not to have this happen. But fundamentally, this is how the thing works. Sounds splendid, doesn't it? And many feminists have been very enthusiastic about it. Let me make two final points about it before I discuss this whole business of alleged matriarchy and so on. The first thing is this. It is a total fallacy to suppose that in a society like this, in which the status of women was very high, decisions, by the way, what we would call political decisions, although the word is not very apposite, taken by the whole adult population, women as well as men. But in effect, if we can accept Morgan's interpretation anyway, basically the elderly women, the most elderly women, exercise what amounted to a veto on appointments. The whole thing struck him as fantastically democratic, but not democratic in our sense, all decisions had to be taken unanimously. Nevertheless, you know, basically, the status of women in the political sense was very high. You'd think that makes it a nice, peaceful one. On the contrary, the Iroquois were, as a matter of historical record, a most bloodthirsty and ferocious lot. Now, the point needs to be made calmly. You know, it's quite possible to combine a situation in which the status of women is very high, much higher than it is even now in our society, very much higher than the 19th century, in which their influence is at least as great, if not greater, than the corresponding men, which nevertheless is a society in which the values of war, the infliction of pain, you know, they used to talk to people, they used to talk to captives, it was a sport, it was done largely by the women too. The point being, if he is good enough, as to say, if he can endure a great deal without showing pain, he may be good enough to be taken in, to be initiated, and so on. If not, sit back. Right? They were ferocious. A whole series of wars. We happen to know about these wars because they corresponded, of course, with the beginnings of the struggle, right through the struggle between the English and the French for control of what is now northern New York and Canada. And they fought on one side or the other. Highly militaristic society, at the same time egalitarian, at the same time communal property ownership, at the same time matrilineal, and if not female dominated, a society in which the influence of females was vastly higher than in any civilized society which we know. Now then, Morgan generalized from that. He said, look, this is the original state of affairs. Not only that, it must have existed, not just in these societies of barbarian cultivators, but in the savages that preceded them. He didn't just say this, he collected information on a questionnaire basis, and he satisfied himself that the information led to this conclusion. So we have this vast theoretical scheme based on the existence of classificatory relationships, which takes you back and back and back. And to ultimately the origins of human society, and hence the idea that because the relationship between copulation and birth was not understood, that's why you have matrilineal descent, it was argued. And all this is hypothetical, though, so we must make the distinction between what Morgan and others could actually observe in particular societies and the generalizations drawn from them, and therefore it was argued the status of women was higher in the past. Now, why have we heard of Morgan? This worthy New York capitalist, because that's what he was, supporter of the Republican Party, indeed, he was a politician, a Republican politician in New York State. We have heard of him because of a historical accident, so to say. The book Ancient Society formed the basis for Engels' study in which Marx collaborated the origins of the family, private property and the state. Now then, I said earlier on, certain circumstances, certain assumptions, in particular the confidence of the bourgeoisie at that time, made it possible for them to think in terms of generalizations, whether right or wrong, which now they cannot do, because they were confident the history was going their way. When you think history is going your way, you are quite prepared to believe in causation, historic forces and so on. When history is not going your way, as Carr observed, you put everything down to accident and ill intention. At that time, history was going their way, as they thought. And so, the whole notion, actually, Morgan's type scheme was acceptable, basically acceptable. Of course, it wasn't acceptable to the people who were still dominated by religion, but, I mean, really dominated by religion, although Morgan himself was a Presbyterian. Nevertheless, it was acceptable in general terms. Once, however, Engels had taken this scheme, and he took his data from Morgan, not only from Morgan, but centrally from Morgan. In particular, he took this scheme about the relationship between the sexes, the matrilineal plan, and so on, and attempted to show how it had dissolved, giving rise to civilization on the basis of classical texts. Once that had happened, and once the turn of the century came, there was a complete reaction amongst the bourgeois ethnologists. And the reaction took the form, in effect, of saying, there is no system, there are no universal stages, every society is unique, and so on and so forth. Incidentally, you see, we must distinguish between what is true and its political tendency. The political tendency here was reactionary, no question about it, but it is also true, as a matter of fact, that some of the criticisms that were made about the stages theory, the universal scheme, were in reality valid. Now, we have to ask ourselves, basically, because this is the reason that the subject is at all alive today, we have to ask ourselves, what do we actually know? As opposed to various kinds of speculation and long chains of reasoning and conjecture, what do we actually know? One, about the evolution of human society in the past. Two, about the specific question of kinship society and the status of women. Three, the origins of civilization. And we can say, actually, three things. One, the great bulk of the detailed schemes which people like Morgan and through him Engels utilise, will not do. They will not do for a reason, a whole number of reasons, but one is good enough. They were thinking in terms of a relatively short time scale. This whole business about the argument about the use of language proves what has existed before. I haven't gone into that, if you want to. Actually, it's plausible enough if you are thinking of, what, I don't know, 50, 100 generations or something. It becomes utterly unreliable, utterly untenable, when you think in terms of human society in the sense of cultural toolmakers, although not men of our own species, going back for more than a million years. The whole method has to be discarded. Second, we can say, nevertheless, the actual scheme, Ferguson, Morgan, Engels, of the not as a universal stage for all societies, but nevertheless as a means of generalization, first starting in gathering stage, and we can put dates on it now, from the very beginnings of human society in the very remote past until 12,000 years ago at the earliest, there was no other kind of society. They were right about that. They were also right, now here, that we can say is a fact, here we have to say it's a matter of probability. All those societies at that stage of development that did survive were kinship societies. Therefore, the assumption that past societies were kinship societies seems well established. Seems well established. There is no direct evidence one way or another. But the overwhelming probability, you ask yourself, how can such pre-class societies hold together, is that. Thirdly, the business, the argument about the originally high status of women will not do. Now, I'm sorry that it won't do, and I don't say to do this with any pleasure, but there are various works written by various, particularly feminists, since the mid-60s. You know, matriarchal early society, it's all rather good, and it's all run by women, and it's all peaceful, and so on and so forth, and then these nasty Indo-Europeans, or someone comes in from the outside, male domination, war, and so on and so forth. Now, if that was what had happened, it would be important. It would tell us something. We have to say that if one looks at the evidence coldly and realistically, you say, one, societies in the pre-agricultural stage, that is societies much more primitive than the Iroquois, judging by the Australians and various others, that lasted long enough for scientific observation, even if they are matrilineal, that is to say, descent is counted in the female line, even if they are, and not all of them are, a very significant fact, there were some hunter-gatherer societies in the recent past that actually reckoned descent in the male line, which shows you the shift can occur even in hunter-gatherer societies. But even where they're matrilineal, the status of women is not necessarily high. Secondly, it is the case, however, that given what became the historical mainstream, that is to say, the development of agriculture in the Middle East, and everything that followed from it, then civilization in the Middle East, in the specific, what was in practice the specific historical mainstream, actually there was a stage in which the status of women, if not originally high, and although it can't be proved one way or the other, you know, you could say 19th century Australians are not 20th century BC Syrians or what have you. Nevertheless, I don't believe it was high. You know, I'm not at all convinced by the high status argument. If it was originally not high, it became so. Now, why can we say this? Well, curiously enough, we can say this because one of the best founded of all generalizations, there are no known exceptions, is that in every kind of hunter-gatherer or primitive agricultural society, there is a marked sexual division of labor. And it runs like this. By and large, men do the large-scale hunting. Large-scale means hunting that involves going considerable distances and often considerable time, and women taking away for considerable periods. And women move more slowly because they're encumbered with children. Incidentally, in such societies, the period of development, children are commonly suckled, or were commonly suckled, for a very long time, 2 or 3 years. How this arose, I don't know. I mean, functionally, it's obvious. It's a method of contraception. It helps population control. But how it actually evolved is difficult to say. But the fact it is, the women therefore are encumbered. And therefore, they collect plant food and they hunt small game. Now, this division of labour existed in all the hunter-gatherer societies we know. Therefore, it is safe to assume that the ancestors of the first agriculturalist in the Middle East, you know, tremendous revolution, the most important thing that's ever happened in the whole course of human development since the origin of our species itself, the discovery of agriculture, must have been the work of women. Now, we cannot say directly how their kinship system worked, but the analogies with what are known from the Iroquois and a whole number of other societies are extremely suggestive. Therefore, the whole business of the material that Engels used, you know, the interpretation of Greek myths, which is a fantastically chancy business, by the way, you know, interpret them in 50 different ways, but nevertheless, the evidence for matrilineal descent in the Middle East is strong in that period. The shift over to another is strong. Consequently, we are probably reasonably safe in regarding the earliest agricultural societies, not just in the Middle East, but their European and other offshoots, as very, very similar to Morgan's Iroquois. And therefore, that the status of women within them was high, not because it had always been high, but because their role in the process of social production was the more significant one. You know, the Iroquois men hunted and fought. But hunting was much less important to the economy, was less central to the economy than agriculture. Ditto, so far as we are able to ascertain, with all the early agricultural societies in the Middle East, and spreading into Europe, a whole lot of them moving into Europe at various times. Finally, I think we can with reasonable confidence say this. Although the details of the Morgan-Engels scheme of social evolution will not do, one, because it is possible to show so many factual exceptions, a lot of the data was misinterpreted. Two, because in any case the method is faulty. The method of arguing back from language will not do over the sort of time scale we have got. Nevertheless, the central and very important aspect that Engels drew out, the question of the origins of class society, how it happened, what happened to the status of women, with that it is the best approximation we have, and likely to remain so because there are intrinsic areas of uncertainty. But this is fundamentally what he said, and this, so far as I can tell, is on the basis of what we know now, which is considerably more than Engels knew, right, as we know through whole theories of development since, valid. What happened is this. What did the high status of women depend on? It depended on collective ownership, the matrilineal clan system. Once, however, you have got agriculture, you have a potential surplus. Then the whole argument about the control of the surplus, the whole business of the evolution of proto-classes, which you can see in many barbarian societies, and ultimately private property, the central importance of slavery in this process, slaves of the clan and so on, becoming in reality support for a section of the population, chiefs, what have you, and so on, the disillusionment of clan property, the evolution of private property, therefore the class struggle, therefore the beginnings of the state, going through at a rate of knots. This process, you understand, took rather a long time. The earliest agricultural societies we know of on present dating are about 10,000 BC, and the earliest states not much older than 3,000 or 3,500, right? But compressing that long development into a short period of time essentially occurred as Engels argued it had occurred. The subsequent evidence reinforces rather than weakens this part of the thesis. And finally, you know, he said the disillusionment of clan property, the breaking up of the matrilineal clan, the switch to descent in the matrilineal line, what did he call it? The world historic defeat of the female sex, that is certainly right too. You see, and as a matter of fact, the fact that he was wrong about the initially high status of women under savage societies really reinforces this, because Engels was not consistent enough in his own argumentation. He was not a consistent enough historical materialist. Look, the high status of women depended on their role in the productive process. When that became central, as long as that property was collected, right, then their status becomes high. Once that ceases to be the case, once their role ceases to be central to the productive process, or before it was, before and after, it's lower. But of course, once you have got the disintegration of the clan system, then the whole business of the collective process of socialising children, the individualisation of the family, two things going on at the same time. One, productive process is shifting, increasingly dominated by men, development of slavery, surplus, all the rest of it. Two, the woman is pushed into the position of dependence, not on a group of men, which is bad enough, but on individual men, and consequently, the whole question. On that, basically, you know, the feminist writers are right, even though they have got soggy and sentimental and often unscientific ways of arguing it, fundamentally they're right. I conclude, not with prehistory, but with the obvious lesson, in terms of the status of women. There is one way and only one way in which the status of women can be genuinely equal to that of men. And that is when women are at least equally involved in the central aspects of the productive process. And therefore, and this follows as night follows from day, when the upbringing of children becomes a collective rather than an individual family function, that is to say when it is socialized, because that is a necessary condition for the women to play a central role in the process of production. Can that be achieved under capitalism? To a degree it has been. Again, here I think there's a lot of sentimentality and sockiness. I will argue that the combination of the development of the capitalist system in the 20th century, including its wars, with its spin-off technology and therefore relatively efficient contraception, has done more to raise the status of women than, you know, the dust of ages, God knows how long. Right? The status of women under capitalism is not lower than it was in pre-capitalist class societies. Actually, it is incomparably higher and has been from the beginning. But the process is inherently limited by the fact that although, what, 40% of the female of the workforce is female, they are not central to the productive process. They are the first to be squeezed at the edge. They are in secondary jobs, part-time work, and so on. And finally, the process of child-rearing is still individualised, although it's partially socialised, you know, the state educational system and so on, to a significant degree, it is still individualised. Therefore, although I think that in this sense, what happened under capitalism shows you what is possible under socialism, in this respect, as in a whole number of other respects, you know, Engels' notion, the invading socialist society, nevertheless, the culmination of the process requires a socialist revolution. And we are therefore, although we may sometimes put it very crudely, nevertheless absolutely correct to say there cannot be real, genuine women's liberation without a socialist revolution. Okay, now I've rambled all over the place and talked about various things. Let's see what other people have to say. I haven't got a chair in here, so you know.